This week, John Burbage of Sea Alaska Corporation in Southeast, Tim Wallace of the Doyon Regional Corporation in the Interior, and Byron Malott of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I'm Mo Osley, and welcome to Potlatch. I attended the Tanana Chiefs Conference held at Fairbanks March 15th through the 17th, and the keynote speaker was John Burbage, president of Sea Alaska Regional Corporation. He is also a commissioner of the American Indian Policy Review Commission and gave a preliminary report on his findings with special reference to Alaska.
Indians and Alaska Natives were and are involved in every phase of the organization and implementation of the American Indian Policy Review Commission. To the greatest extent possible, the findings of the commission will reflect the feelings and analyses of the Indian and Alaska Native communities. Competent and dedicated Native Americans from Maine to California and Alaska served on these investigative arms of the commission. Reports based on field hearings and related research and review resulted in various findings and recommendations that were considered and shaped by the commission and prepared for possible inclusion in a tentative final report. The primary emphasis was and is on broad tribal participation and tribal consultation. I can't emphasize enough that what we have here is an effort by the government itself, with the most basic Indian involvement, to pose the question, what changes should be made and how can those changes best be achieved? All of us have been in the position to react before at what others have begun, at what others have initiated. The commission, in my view, offers us an opportunity to lead in these changes and to state what we would like to see. The extent of the challenge facing the American Indian Policy Review Commission, and in effect, the Indian nation of this country, can best be put in proper perspective by the following quotation from a report, and I quote, "Ultimately, this historic commission is charged with the responsibility of producing an exhaustive report which can chart the next century of federal Indian relationships." The following are some of the findings and the recommendations that I will present to you now. One, regardless of in the main, the Alaska Natives were not located on reservations, the status of their traditional tribes and the nature of their relationship to the United States are essentially the same as those of other American Natives. They still desperately need and are entitled to the special services that the United States customarily makes available to Natives based on their status as such. The Settlement Act was not intended to affect and did not affect the sovereign powers residing in the pre-existing Alaska Native tribes. Four, the Alaska Natives should be eligible, along with all other American Natives, to receive the benefits of all existing and future legislation and programs designed generally to promote the development and welfare of Native Americans. There is a need, five, to establish an order of preference among competing applications of various organizations that seek contracting opportunities. Six, the Tlingit-Haida Indians constitute a single tribal entity of which the Central Council is a general and supreme governing body. Seven, the authority given the Secretary of the Interior by the Settlement Act, where necessary, to reserve easements across lands to be granted to the Native corporations and at periodic points along the courses of major waterways was intended to be exercised strictly for the purpose of providing access to remaining public lands and discharging international treaty obligations. In undertaking to reserve easements of other types for other purposes, the Secretary is grossly exceeding his authority. What we're saying here is that we consider that the Alaska Natives were entitled to a full entitlement of the land promised under the terms of the Claims Settlement Act, and it is outside the right and the exercise of discretion by the Secretary of the Interior to reduce that entitlement. 8, since Congress itself mandated the conveyance of 40 million acres of land to the natives and native corporations, and by and large define the areas from which the land is to come, the Secretary, prior to making the grants called for by the Act, should not be required to prepare environmental impact statements. 9, the Settlement Act contemplated that all lands to which the natives and native corporations are entitled would be conveyed not later than early in 1976, and at the present time, more than a year after Congress provided the process should be complete, only a fraction of the land has been conveyed. This unconscionable delay is entirely attributable to maladministration by the previous Secretary of the Interior and is seriously eroding the value of the compensation Congress intended the natives to receive. There is no reason to expect more expeditious administration in the future unless Congress itself takes a hand and compels it. 10, makes reference to the fact that the Buckley Amendment became law when passed by the Congress, and it recognized that the natives would receive less than their entitlement simply because the pipeline would be on stream at a later time. And because the pipeline would be on stream at a later time, the monies would be received by the natives at a later time, and this would hurt us financially. And what we have said here in our finding is that this part of the Act passed by the Congress should be funded. And the fact that it has not been funded has been attributable to the past posture of the administration. I am impressed with the love for the land that is basic to being a Native American. I am impressed with the importance that all Native Americans attach to knowing who we are and from whence we have come. I am impressed with the certainty that the Native American nation will deal successfully with the future while remembering its roots and its heritage. But most of all, I am inspired with a certain knowledge that we are brothers bound together by spiritual ties, a love for the land, and a timeless reverence for life.
Kenny Rankin. Tim Wallace, president of Doyon, the Interior Native Corporation, talks about taxation of native land that was set up under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, talks about Senate Bill 35 and where some of the conflicts are.
There is a conflict whether the term unimproved land, as defined in Senate Bill 35, is the same as real property or not developed or leased to third parties under ANCSA. Senate Bill 35, in defining unimproved land, uses standards of current physical additions or alterations to the land, which would affect the value or income-producing potential of the land. There is a possibility that the tax as proposed is in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. While I have not had the opportunity to fully research this point, it would appear that the state would be treating one type of property different than other properties of similar character. The only property which is being taxed is property in the unincorporated borough. No tax is levied by the state on identical property in incorporated boroughs. This tax cannot be said to be a substitute for such borough taxes, since there are assessment rates varies borough to borough. While invariance in the millage rate is acceptable from one borough to the next, the fact is the state, which is acting as a taxing authority, may require the tax to be struck down unless all lands in the state is subject to it. Under the bill, it calls that the proceeds of the tax will be deposited in a special account in the general fund, and that an amount equal to the net amount of the revenue derived in the preceding year is authorized to be appropriated for the benefit of the unorganized boroughs. Article 9, Section 7 of the Constitution provides that the proceed of any state tax shall not be dedicated to any special purposes. I have not had the opportunity to review the Attorney General's opinion on the point, but the provisions of Senate Bill 35 strongly indicate that creation of a special fund which is dedicated in its use. This certainly would appear to be the intent, although the language of the bill is sufficiently vague as to arguably allow the funds to be utilized in any manner so long as a benefit was derived by the unorganized borough. Under the state constitution, it says that when you tax somebody, you cannot set up a special fund in which you can use that tax. It has to be put in the general fund and to be used on a broad base, whatever is determined by the legislature. The whole tax structure is basically one that will shift the tax burden to the native enterprises for native services provided in the rural areas. However, the decision as to the tax rate, exemption, and use of the funds will be made by a body in the excess of 75% of whose members are elected by persons neither subject to the tax nor the intended recipients of its benefits. Close attention should be paid to having such a body setting the tax policies, this being the legislature. This type of situation closely parallels the one man, one vote case of the 50s and the 60s, in which the state senate were required to be apportioned on a population base. The section which provides for a return of the tax dollars paid in services to the unorganized borough is very weak. A twofold danger exists with it. First, the money may never be spent for services in the rural areas. Secondly, the money may be utilized to provide existing services which the state is currently required to provide anyway. One might see the tax dollars being applied to reimburse the state for school foundation money. existing welfare programs, and other services which the state is also providing to a greater extent in the urban areas. In the long run, if the legislature is going to tax the unorganized boroughs, which may be the case perhaps next year or the year after, then Doyon and the villages should explore the creation of borough governments in order to provide for local control on allocation decisions as well as the appropriate taxing levels.
I was what they call a circus child. The big top was my home each year for a while. Mama was an actress then, but in the summer she'd fill in with the truth they called the west wind. I recall the smell of sawdust after the rain. The summer you so long when everything changed. You stole my mother's heart away, and it was hard for her, they say, 'cause you risked your life every day. And Mama always cried and closed her eyes until your act was through. And me, I'd seem fine, and all the time you never knew I loved you too. No one told the story, and you never knew just why it was we were so afraid for you. That prophecy the gypsies made, we called a superstitious game. Still we have believed it just the same. I can still see your figure crushed on the ground. And now, when the circus comes to town, I let my children have their day, but me, I tend to stay away. You see, my father died that same way. Thank you.
Helen Reddy. Our final segment has incoming President of the Alaska Federation of Natives, Byron Mallott, discussing upcoming legislation pertaining to D2 lands and what the highest priority is.
Our highest priority is to protect subsistence. And then in the next breath say, we want to maximize the economic development capability on our own lands. And some people have already pointed that out to us as a huge inconsistency. But we don't view it that way. If we did view it that way, the whole premise of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, in my estimation, would be thrown out the window. The way we're going to protect our future as Alaska Native people, and the way we're going to have the strength and the capability to ensure that our goals and objectives are those that are determined by us and achieved by us, is to make those corporations, both now and for the future, strong economic profit-making structures. If they are not, we're ultimately going to suffer because we ain't ever going to have a different kind of structure. We can't go back to Congress and say, hey, you know, let's start this process over. But more than that, we don't think that there's an inconsistency between subsistence and economic development, because the difficulty between economic growth and subsistence, the way Native people define it and the way Native people use it, is more a matter of management than it is definition. Just let me cite one example, the whole transportation thing, where we say that we want adequate access and egress to and from Native lands. And at the same time, we say we want to protect subsistence resources. The way you do that is to set up management and decision-making mechanisms that are responsive to your number one priority, and that is subsistence. And if you want to build a road to an area on Native lands that is necessary for some economic profit-making project, you make the decision based upon whether or not, you know, that will adversely over the long run really impact subsistence use of those same lands. And if, for example, the cheapest way to route a road is through a river valley, but that's also the place that Natives use most heavily for subsistence uses, then under our system of priorities, you'd have to reroute that transportation route some other way. So we're saying that if it's done properly, if economic development decisions are made in a manner and through mechanisms that are very sensitive to the subsistence and cultural requirements of Native corporations and their shareholders, that it is workable. The history of our U.S. in the past, in terms of conservation, in terms of the environment, in terms of preservation of natural resources, has for all practical purposes been a disaster. And they're looking to Alaska to salvage national conscience with respect to preserving lands and resources for the future. AFN, recognizing that the D2 issue is probably going to be the most important legislation we've got to deal with to come down the road in some time, has hired Stuart Udall to be our legislative representative in Washington, specifically on D2. You're probably all aware that Mr. Udall is a former Secretary of the Interior. He's a former congressman who had a major role in the passage of the Statehood Act during the time that he was in Congress. He was one of the few congressmen at the time of statehood who pointed out very clearly that one of the major unresolved issues with statehood was Native claims And of course, Mr. Udall is the person who imposed the state land freeze in 1966, which started the ball rolling toward the passage of the Clyde-Selman Act. His brother, Morris Udall, is chairman of the House Interior Committee, which will have full responsibility for development of D2 legislation on the House side. But as your villages and the Tanana chiefs and your corporations, from time to time, either at the village or regional level, talk about subsistence, or would like us, AFN, to come out and talk with you about it. If you think you've got specific ideas that might be useful to us, boy, we really want to hear it, because this bill is going to be the native people's bill, and if it's going to be that, it's got to have your input every step of the way.
Listening to music from the Kenny Rankin album. I'm Mo Wasley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.